Hi, everyone. Before we get started with today's episode, I need to address some recent news. And also, I want to issue a trigger warning for the next minute or two. I'm going to be talking about sexual assault. So if that's trigger for you, fast forward a minute or two until we get to the start of the episode. So at the end of February 2020, a woman came forward with the story that alleged that Timothy Hutton raped her shortly after he became famous. I don't want to go into the details here, but the story was originally published on BuzzFeed News. So if you want to read the full account, you can go there and find it. What I do want to make clear here is that we here at Let's Go Steal a Podcast believe the victim and we stand with her. I've discussed this issue with my other co-host and we honestly did consider just stopping the podcast altogether. But we have at this moment in time, anyways, decided to move forward. The fact is we were fans of the show before these allegations broke. We're going to do our best to separate the character of Nate Ford from the actor who played him. And as always, we're going to apply a critical eye to what the show is saying in every instance, just the way that I feel that we have for the past three seasons of the show. But as this story develops, we might need to change this approach. So, and I'll keep you updated if we decide to do something different. And as always, I welcome your thoughts on how we should handle this going forward. Thank you. And let's move on to this episode of Let's Go Steal a Podcast. So it has been a long time since I watched these episodes, or this episode, but I do have the transcript up, and I don't know if I'll remember anything about it, so I'm glad I've got two co-hosts to help.
I was counting on you for a lot of it.
I think as we start talking, I'll remember things, but like, and that's how it usually is, but right now I'm just like, head empty, wine glass full, who knows?
Starting us off on a real efficient note here, as
I
always.
I love it. I'm really excited for the tangents tonight, y'all. Let's start. And if we go on tangents, that's fine with me. Obviously, I don't care. Welcome back, everybody. I know it's been a really, really, really long time since we had an episode, but I think we're going to record two episodes this weekend and another one on Tuesday. So I'm just going to put them out the next 3 weeks. You're going to have new episodes. I know. But, you know, we got a little behind because we had here in the United States, you know, we had an insurrection and then we had an inauguration and we just needed some time. It didn't feel like the moment to talk about an episode of a show where someone impersonates or someone who's a criminal becomes an FBI agent and gets away with his crime. So but maybe we'd pass for a couple weeks, let the dust settle. And now we're back to talk about the DB Cooper job. And to make it up to you for being gone for so long, I have not one, but two co-hosts. It's their first time on the pod together. I've got Jen.
Woo, hi.
And Robin.
Hello.
So yeah, like I said, we're gonna talk about the DB Cooper job, which aired on my dad's birthday, August 26th, 2012.
Hey, that's the day after my birthday.
What? I love
and,
it.
And my birthday some is 2 days before your mom's birthday.
That's right. My mom's birthday is coming up on February 15th, and Jen's is 2 days before that on the 13th.
Oh, nice.
This episode was, and since we're talking about birthdays, mine's November 21st.
It's already passed.
I don't want to be left out. I love my birthday. Okay. This episode was directed by Mark Roskin and it was written by Chris Downey. So we've got like the original crew here putting this one on. And they were very excited about this one to do DB Cooper. I think the minute they knew they were officially moving the crew to Portland, they were like, we're doing DB Cooper. It's happening.
Yeah. How do you not?
Right. I did not really know about DB Cooper until maybe this episode.
What?
Until 2012.
I know. I guess I.
I'm sorry. Was Without a Paddle not your favorite movie of all time in 2004?
That's a really good point. Dan, we could take this whole podcast into just a Without a Paddle podcast, probably with very little effort.
Yeah.
Look, I was into Seth Green, very much so.
Excuse me.
Not into Dax Shepard. So I passed on Without a Paddle.
How do you feel about Matthew Lillard?
I do really like Matthew Lillard.
Good, because you're going to have to talk about him next week.
That movie.
What?
Which one?
You, Jen.
They did all their own stunts in that movie. I know.
I really love D.B. Cooper, just so we're clear.
Yeah.
D.B. Cooper and Roanoke were the mysteries that when I was a kid, I was like, I'm gonna solve those. Figure that out. Because as, you know, a six-year-old girl in the Southwest, I was clearly in a good position to, like, solve major American mysteries. Yeah. But I was determined.
See, and I had already gone to Scotland with my mysteries. I was like, I'm going to see Nessie.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to see Nessie. And Jen and I went. We did not see her. I just want her to be real. I just want her to be real so bad. Like, I don't care if it doesn't make sense.
Absolutely. She could have been real. Maybe they just, like, I mean, obviously it was a dude that drew it. And usually they exaggerate on size.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she could have been a small thing. But I think she was there.
She's still amazing.
Yeah. She's amazing. Anyway, so this episode features some flashbacks, and this is not our first episode of flashbacks. We love a flashback episode where the actors play the people in the flashbacks. It's chef's kiss. It's so good. But a flashback to the 1970s of an FBI agent's final regrets, his failure to capture the hijacker, D.B. Cooper. I don't want to ruin anything. But yeah, we get some flashbacks. We get one of our favorite recurring characters, Agent McSweeten, showing up, and that's a lot of fun. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Because it starts pretty exciting in FBI headquarters in the middle of the night. Two people are breaking in. And
two masked people.
Who could these bad guys be stealing from the FBI? Oh,
they're
no.
I mean, they just were just following guidelines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the leverage crew would always follow safety guidelines.
I meant to look up actually if there even are FBI offices in Portland. It seems there like it would be.
Are there not FBI offices everywhere?
No.
Did I learn this from the X-Files?
They tend to, there's in like state capitals and large cities, but I don't know if Portland would be a big enough city. I don't know.
Because that's not the capital. That's Eugene.
Oh.
I doubt they would be in Eugene.
There is? All right.
It's between a Target and a Dutch Bros coffee.
God bless Portland. Well,
there you go.
I assume there's a bird on it somewhere.
And if not, there will be.
Yeah.
Too good. I'm still sad that Fred Armisen didn't actually get his cameo on Leverage, but what are you going to do?
Was he vying for one?
He really likes Leverage, and he was going to be on the first episode of the season, but they couldn't get the scheduling to work out, so he didn't get to be on.
Would it have been one of his Portland characters or him?
Yeah, it would have been one of his Portlandia characters.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's always the reboot. Revival.
That's true, but they're not in Portland anymore. But I don't think that he cared that it was in Portland.
There's lots of things in New Orleans that it could be. Maybe there'll be Vampire Diaries characters just walking through in the background from the originals.
That'd be awesome. Some American Horror Story coven situation happening back there.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, what other shows are set in... I mean, we could have some True Blood. They came down...
A lot of Criminal Minds takes place
that's
in New
That's
Orleans.
A lot of vampires, though. You got True Blood, you got... That's too many.
Interview with a Vampire.
They just get turned into Vampire Hunters.
I mean, one of the Librarian movies had a vampire in it. And nobody
so did
is
the Librarian
the
show.
Yeah.
Yes.
In the fourth season, because you get Christian Kane being like, I hate vampires. And you're like, oh yeah, right. I get that joke.
And that's when What's-Her-Name got her kiss.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
I watched all of the Librarians in like a week and a half, so
someday I'll get you to make a Librarians podcast.
That's one of the things that we might do in the interim between the new series starting.
Yeah.
But not if we don't finish this episode. So,
all right.
Back to the first scene. Mm-hmm. We got bad guys breaking into the FBI headquarters, but they decide before they're out of the building, when they're in the stairwell, where there are probably still cameras, they take their masks off. And it's mm-hmm. McSweeten, Agent McSweeten, lawful good Agent McSweeten, and Parker. And then you're like, what are you doing? Because you know this is Parker's idea of a date. And you're like, why are you together? But you don't, you're not, you don't really think anything's going on. I have forgotten everything. Then we get a flash to the pub, and Nate sees McSweeten waiting outside. It's like a flashback, and he's like, no, no, no. Maybe it's not a flashback. Maybe it's after they're broken. He's like,
bring FBI agents to the bar.
Yeah, that's, no, 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 no. You cannot cross the streams. It's not okay.
Well, you and have to support like, small business, though. I mean, bring them all in. Why is he kicking people out?
Yeah. And he's also like, why would you agree to break into an FBI building with an FBI agent? Who thinks you are an FBI agent?
Well, no, that's her defense. She's like, it's fine. He still thinks I'm an agent in deep cover. And Nate's just, I think, gives up at that point, which I'm fairly certain that Hardison has, like, put them in the OPM database, and that, like, Hardison and Parker are, like, earning vacation leave from the FBI. They've got, like, their you know, retirement accounts that are being matched at 5%. Like, he's put them in the leave bank, and every year they join and he donates their leave to people who need it. Like the whole meal deal of federal employment.
I wish I had the attention span of Alec Hardison. I wish that I could focus and complete tasks the way that this man does.
I assume he has some sort of like notes app to-do list.
You know, Parker says she wants to do this for McSweeten because he needs them. And Nate is just pissy because he's been working on taking down this guy with the Ponzi scheme for months. And he doesn't want, he's a one-track dude. He doesn't want to go off on a tangent and help out of like their friend of like four seasons, McSweeten. But then Parker like plays the card and says he's about to lose his father. We like go talk to him. We have to help him. And he's like, oh no. My dad just died recently. I can't handle this. Let's go. Can't have Nate, these regrets.
Nate has very few like buttons to push, but the two he has are like giant and blinking and hard to miss.
Oh yeah. Even Parker Father, can find them. Son. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. If Parker knows what buttons to push, they're really big and blinking. And we find out that his dad is dying of pancreatic cancer. And that they're out of options. So he's just kind of gone home to die. And we also find out that McSweeten is the son of an FBI agent who is a profiler. Or no. Agent Hagen tells him that Nate is a profiler. So sorry. But yeah, McSweeten's dad was an FBI agent here in Portland for like over 40 years. And you can tell that he's like, his dad is his hero. He's like, he was putting bad guys away, taking them off the streets. But he wants to do one thing for his dad before he dies, and that is to help him bring D.B. Cooper to justice. Which Hardison is like, this is our job? Like, the number one unsolved crime in America? Like, that's what you want us to do? Because that's not hard. But Nate's like, no, we have to take down this Oliver Schmidt guy. Like, that's our job. That's what I want to be doing. But Sophie comes in, and we find out that Sophie is a D.B. Cooper fangirl.
Oh, yeah.
In the commentary, they were like, oh, yeah, she definitely had, like, a poster of the police sketch on her wall as a girl. And then I was trying to do the math on like how old Sophie would have been. And I forgot.
And she was like born in like the early 60s.
Yeah. But I was like, she probably was like, I was, you know, I was basing it off Gina Bellman's age. Like she would have been like 10.
Yeah.
10 or 11. That could be completely wrong because I can't remember numbers, but I did do math at some point. I want that out. I want the credit for that.
It's just, it's always great when one of the other ones is like, oh no, I'm going to do the.
She was five. Okay, never mind. She was
five.
Was it
in 71? Was it in 71, right?
Yes.
Yeah, she was born in 66. Day before Thanksgiving.
Okay, so then yes. She was five. But maybe, I mean, when she was 10, she learned about
it. You know, when you were 5 years old and you were looking at police sketches and you were like, dang. That one with the sunglasses.
You know, Parker was looking at police sketches.
I'm pretty sure if my parents would have let me, I would have hung a D.B. Cooper sketch on my wall in the 90s.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I just think as soon as she was old enough to learn about D.B. Cooper, she became a fangirl. And she's the person who does this exposition for us. If you were like me and didn't really know much about the D.B. Cooper case, that in 1971, the day before Thanksgiving, a 727 takes off from Portland, bound for Seattle. It's hijacked by this man, a passenger who goes by the name Dan Cooper. And I learned so much about this crime from this fictional show. That so much though that I don't like completely believe it's real. Like I'm like, this is just a fictional story. No, it's real.
They didn't put all of the details in the episode, but what they have in there is correct. Like there's a little more to it.
Yeah. But for the most part, they were pretty authentic about it. Except for that it wasn't McSweeten's dad.
Well, yeah.
What a coincidence that would be though. What if they had, his name had been McSweeten and they just, they've been waiting.
Yeah.
All this time.
Or what if the guy at McSweeten was like, crap, those guys got it so right. I've gotten away with it for 30 years.
If that's true, like his partner, I would be like, guys, it's fake. I promise. It
wasn't me.
And he's like, statute of limitations. You can't get me.
I like to imagine, though, that if the real D.B. Cooper is still alive and out there, that he, like, randomly turned on this episode and was just watching it, like, oh, so wrong.
They got it all so wrong. And, yeah, Hardison even asked Sophie if she had a poster of D.B. Cooper up over her bed when she was 15. And she doesn't answer. Or no, she says, so what? So what if I did? Mm-hmm. I'm not ashamed. And Elliot has his theory. He's like, no, this man, he jumped from 10,000 feet, but it was 7 below. And he's in the parachute from 1971. Like he didn't make it. Like he is DED dead, to quote Alec Hardison. And Nate's like, yeah, sure. Okay. That means this is a waste of time. Let's move on. But Parker's like, what? No. We have to keep going. And he's like, no, I promised I would try. So I'll go talk to McSweeten's dad. And Hardison's going to dig up the old case file that Parker stole.
So he doesn't have to go far.
Yeah, but it is 80 volumes long.
Does that mean 80 pages?
No, it's probably 80 file folders full.
And not the skinny file folders, the expandable ones, right?
Oh.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it's probably carbon paper.
So hard to read.
Yeah.
Like, disintegrating. But
I mean, you can reuse that to just make your own tracings, right?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Well, they had Xeroxes at that point, so.
You would think at some point the D.B. Cooper file would be digitized, right?
I know. I've been on a tour of not like the FBI archives, but like they have a sort of museum
across
thing
the street.
I got to go into like and meet some of the curators at one point, and they are starting the process of digitizing some things, but it is very slow, because you also have to look at like some things they don't want to digitize from a security perspective, right? Like, because paper is so much more secure, so you got to do that, and then there's manpower and you got to label everything. And I did get to see DB Cooper's boarding pass though, which was very cool. That's but not awesome. His cigarette butts, because they got lost somewhere. They are somewhere in the FBI building, and I think they're not sure where. And I'm not sure how you'd ever know what cigarette, like, you find a little bag full of cigarette butts, like, what are you going to do with that? Like,
someone was cleaning and threw it away. They were like, this is disgusting. What's slob? Smoking
anymore?
Yeah. Well, they've tried to find them for DNA.
Cigarette smoking man.
But.
Oh, yes. Besides him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I as soon as we had DNA technology, I'm sure they were like, yes, let's go down there. Let's do, where are they? Where do they go?
Has anyone in the FBI seen an old cigarette butt?
It's just like a department-wide email, like little wanted poster on the messages boards. So Hardison is also playing a secret agent. I mean, a special agent. Special Agent Alan Thomas. So he goes in and he meets McSweeten. Or no, he meets Steve, McSweeten Sr.'s partner. And he's played by this guy who's in everything, Fred Ward.
He's like absolutely a hey, it's that guy.
Yeah, he's just like a handsome man who's just been in Tremors and.
I feel like he's been in every procedural.
Yeah. And I also feel like he played Wyatt Earp in a TV movie. That for every episode of the show, I could spend 30 minutes going through all the stuff that the actors have been on. We're not going to do that today.
All right. So Hardison is talking to the old partner.
Yes. And he says, you know, I would do anything for Peter. I'll help you out with this. He's the reason I became an FBI agent. And you know, in fact, this whole case is personal because my late wife was a stewardess on that flight. And so Nate's like, okay, well, you know, you're the right guy to ask. So everybody has a theory. What's yours? And he just starts naming other people's theories. And he basically is like, I don't have one, like take your pick from all of these that other people have had. But since y'all knew DB Cooper, what are y'all's theories?
I when I heard that, I was like, okay, there were only 6 stewardesses on that flight. Like, how small is this? How small is Portland? That his wife was a stewardess on that flight? I'm just saying.
Yeah, although it makes sense that they do connect that later for like why they would be friends, like why that they had met each other through the case.
They do.
But yeah, I always thought that because there's a lot of like people who claim to be DB Cooper, but none of the people ever like had any of the money or anything, or any sort of proof that they were DB Cooper, except there's one woman who has come forward that she thinks it was her uncle, which gets mentioned briefly in the episode. And there's some evidence that maybe it was him. He's the one I always thought it was.
All right. I like that.
But honestly, I think Elliot's probably right, and he probably died.
Yeah.
Like, he's probably in the woods somewhere. And
which is so lame. Like, come on, DB Cooper. Come on. Meanwhile, Nate goes to talk to McSweeten's dad, and okay, real quick, very small nitpicky thing. We get an exterior shot of this house, and then we get an interior shot of them walking in the door, and those houses are not the same.
The
windows are wrong. You can see like part of the facade of the front of the house when they open the door, and it's like a completely different brick. Like, it's a totally different style house inside and out. It was very upsetting.
That's It's always dumb when they don't, when it, like, I get that sometimes continuity errors happen, but when it's something that's that unnecessary, like, just don't show an exterior of the house.
Exactly. There are
other ways of figuring out that you're, like, adjusting to that. You can do a pan up from Nate's feet as he's walking into the house, and that's a, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, you could show the mailbox outside that says McSweeten or something. I don't know, like, you don't have to. And later they use a very time period perfect house exterior and interior that they managed to find to film in. And it just was weird that they had this totally different house.
It's a weird misstep. The show normally is tighter than that.
Yeah. But that's okay. So they walk in and he's reading. He looks fine. Like, he, to me, doesn't look like someone who's on death's door, but I don't.
Cancer's weird.
That's true. That's true. But he's reading the Odyssey. And Nate sits down and he, McSweeten leaves, and his dad says, "Tally-ho, son." And you can tell that this is like a little a thing that they do, and it's really, really sweet.
They say tally-ho and he like spins his finger in a circle.
Yeah, just like a cute little beat. And so Nate sits down and like starts asking him about the case, and so he, you know, starts telling him the story. It began the day before Thanksgiving 1971, and then it's like flashback to 1971, and we see that Nate is playing older McSweeten, and Sophie is playing Mrs. McSweeten. And
so throughout the whole episode, they really lean into like dressing people in period appropriate clothing and hair and bits of facial hair. And some of them really pull, like, everything Parker wears, all of her, like, she's great. She looks fantastic.
You do not talk bad about that hair. That hair was an odd
No, all of it was, and Sophie looked amazing in everything except for one vest in the Christmas scene. Even she couldn't make that vest work.
Yeah.
There's one, and the facial hair is great on all of them. Aldis clearly wins with the sideburns he gets. But there's also one part when Elliot's wearing the, when, I don't know, later when you see him, he's wearing the paisley shirt with the super wide collar over the lapel of his coat. And it's just like, man, you can't, nope, even you can't do that. Like, and then later he's in bell bottoms and it's like, oh, who would have guessed that Christian Kane, like his proportions were great in bell bottoms.
He loves
them. In them, out of them. I mean, either way.
Yeah. But that is something on John, on the blog, on Kung Fu Monkey, he talks about how part of the reason why they went with this episode was because of Christian Kane's hair, because they wanted to do another flashback episode, but they needed one where, like, his long hair would work. So they,
because they couldn't just shove it under the, like, a, yeah, they shoved it under a helmet before, and that's how they got around it.
It's also weird, though, because he cuts his hair in, like, four episodes.
Yeah.
So
maybe he hadn't decided to do that yet.
Maybe he got his hair, like, blown out into the 70s styles for this and was like, well, this is, it's not going to get any better than this.
Or he's like, this is a long time every morning. Because at one point he kind of has,
like, feathered hair and, like, it's never going to be better.
I know. And I can't get away with this every day. I don't know if this is something I can pull off. So just chop it off. Can't.
But yeah, but Sophie and Parker both look so good with the like big 70s hair.
Yeah, Sophie's got like, they got like the swoop of the bangs across and then like the curl.
Yeah, her like accent's a little,
okay, a little, I thought weird. So too, and I guess she's just trying to do that like Pacific Northwest American accent, which I think is a little different than other places. I mean, Jen, you've lived in the Pacific Northwest.
I do, I don't really remember their native accent there. Just like a little like pretentious American.
It almost sounded like she was trying to do the impression of like someone from a 1970s movie or something. Like it felt like a weird mishmash of a couple of, like, trying to be a little old-timey but also trying to be West Coast, and it just, I don't know, wasn't her best.
And I think it's like, it's not bad, I think, on anybody else. I'd be like, sure, but Gina Bellman's so good at accents that when she does it, you know, the last episode she had like 5 accents in like 2 days. So
yeah,
she was tired. Yeah. She needed a break. And we find out that I really got to remember what McSweetin Senior, he's about to go have his last day at the Portland.
I just call them Senior and Junior.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
All right, so Senior.
Good job.
Is off to his last day at the Portland office because he's been promoted up. I think they're going to Seattle. And so he's just on his last day on the job. It's very much like, I just have one more day until retirement situation. So of course something horrible is going to happen. and it does. So, oh yeah, he's going to go be the chief of the Seattle office. That's what it is. And, but before he goes, he like gives a little rousing speech to his people in Portland, and they clap for him. And he has a big thing about like, you know, it's important to have compassion and put yourself into the shoes of the people that we serve. Even like the people who are perpetrating crimes, to remember that they're human and they all deserve mercy, which I think is really sweet. And I think is like, you know, foretelling of what's going to happen in the rest of the episode.
Hardison's also in the scene as his like buddy.
Yeah, like maybe his old partner or former partner, because they're like, their desks are back to back.
Yeah.
But he's a little cocky.
It did kind of feel like they didn't quite have a place for Hardison in this episode.
Yeah. Also Sophie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In both time periods.
Yeah. I know they cut something else for Sophie at the end, but I don't know if they cut anything for Hardison, but both of them kind of could lift out of the episode really without any trouble, which like not every episode can be equitably distributed between all
John
five.
John Rogers is always like, it's a five-hander. Like it's impossible to have every episode, everybody have equal like plot lines and screen time. Then we do get the reveal of Parker, and it's the shot that all of these men really, really love, which is like the legs up reveal of her in a stewardess outfit on the plane, and she's refilling people's drinks, and she stops at a guy who asks for a bourbon and water and then hands her a note, and she assumes, because this is what usually happens, that it's his number or, you know, he's hitting on her. And so she's like, oh, thanks, I'll get you that drink. And then
she tells the other stewardess, like, she has a cute little line about the shorter they make these hemlines, the more these guys think that we're on the menu, and even this doesn't distract them. And she like points to a big wedding engagement ring set, about like saying that like even the fact that she's married doesn't distract them at all.
Yeah. And that she deserves hazard pay. I'm like, yes, you do. This is bullshit.
Well, and then she says something about the guy, like, oh, look, that guy just gave me a note, and they cut back over to who we learn is DB Cooper, and he pulls the magazine up, so like to kind of cover his face. And the second time around, I realized like you can see the back ad of the magazine, like right as he pulls it up over his face, which I did not clock the first time out.
I did not either.
It is a nice piece of foreshadowing.
It's beautiful. It was beautiful. But when she takes the drink back to him, he's like, did you read the note? He like grabs her hand. And so she like pulls it out, and it's his, what would you call it? Like his like, ransom, I want to say note. Ransom. I guess it is a ransom note, but you know, I'm telling her that he's got a bomb in his briefcase and he'll use it if necessary. And he wants her to sit next to him because they're being hijacked. But if like, why? She's just going to sit there. They're not going to know they're being hijacked, because I'm just like, she's just being lazy and sitting with the customer. But no, he just shows her the bomb, actually. And then back at, well, they're in a car on their way somewhere because they've gotten the call that the plane has landed. I guess it's been a little bit since he said he was going to stay over this flight. And they're on their way to the airport and, you know, kind of they're like running down everything. There are 32 passengers on board and only the stewardess, Stephanie Ritter, knows what's going on and the flight crew. And then we found out that the hijackers' demands are $200,000, a refueling truck to meet the plane here in Seattle, and 4 parachutes. So I guess he did go up to Seattle? Because they were in Portland?
I think they landed like normal. I thought the flight was going to Seattle. No?
Yes, no, you're right. It was going from Portland to Seattle, but I didn't realize that Senior had made it from, I thought it was still his last day in Portland. But he's apparently in Seattle.
Yeah.
What's the drive from Portland to Seattle like?
Can't be like that 3 long. Hours? I think.
3 hours? Okay. So he like went in for the last day and then drove up?
Yeah.
Or maybe, yeah.
You know, they were like, it's your first day. Like, it's about to be your first day. Like, come on, this is your first job as chief of the Seattle branch. So
maybe he was acting chief for a while anyhow.
And then he could have just stayed in Portland because that's where the flight took off.
But they landed in Seattle.
I know, but he could have caught him before they left. I'm just saying, a good FBI aide.
Exactly. Like, be proactive. Come on. Yeah.
Also, flight was only 1/3 full. What flight has ever taken off that's only 1/3 full? They would have just canceled it. Been like, guys.
I don't think so in the 70s. That was before deregulation when air travel was still nice.
I know. Well, except for all they were giving people drinks in actual glasses.
I don't know. I also think that if you were the outgoing chief at the Seattle field office and it's your last day and someone calls and says, we just got a call from the airport. Someone has hijacked this flight. You'd be like, cool, the new guy's on his way. Like,
hey, could you get there faster? Thanks.
New phone, who dis? Sorry. Oh, he already left for the day.
He's drunk in his office and he's like, Marjorie, just cancel all my meetings.
I mean, I've been rewatching Mad Men, so I'm imagining a lot of that sort of like malarkey of just,
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so they set up their little field office at the airport, and what are they doing?
Well, they're trying to figure out because they're saying, oh, we need to snipe him on the plane or something because we can't let him go because he's gonna fly to Mexico.
Oh yeah.
And then Senior's like, no, he's gonna land. This is not what he's gonna do. It's fine, we can let him take off again.
Because there's not enough to refuel, right? Oh, he wanted he wants it to refuel. Yeah. And they think that his bomb's a fake and they can't snipe him because the blinds are down on the plane windows.
But he's let all the passengers off. He's just keeping the flight crew and the stewardess.
Yeah. And then Cooper inside is like apologizing to her, saying, I'm sorry I couldn't let you off. Like, I need someone to you know, speak for me.
And get him another bourbon and water.
Right? Just come on. Got to keep this man hydrated. Did
it because it was a bourbon and soda? Not water.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Didn't bother me because I didn't know.
They meant soda water. Just, you know.
Because if I order a vodka soda and they bring back a vodka water and that doesn't have bubblies in it, I would get very upset. And not very upset. I would just be like, thanks, fine, and drink it and never report it back. But still.
You wouldn't hijack the plane?
Did you think that's why he did it? God.
It's like, this bitch got my order wrong.
Yes.
That's why they stopped giving you free drinks on planes. Oh, no, I guess he paid for it.
He did. That's why I like this crime so much, because he was a very nice man.
I do like a polite crime.
Yeah.
Part is apparently true. The stewardesses on the real thing reported that he was incredibly polite. He did tip them, and he had tried to give them extra change, and that he offered when they stopped and they were bringing him the money and parachutes, he offered to have them send meals for the flight crew.
Yeah.
And they were like, no, we're fine. We're not hungry.
I mean, besides the bomb, the really
which
only
may
aggressive
or may not
thing...
have they never determined, I'm not defending this, but they never found out for sure whether he had a bomb.
But he did write that note in all capital letters, which is very aggressive.
Yes. Although they never recovered the note
they
either.
They didn't, but they know it was written in a black felt tip pen. I feel like that's a detail, but they don't really know exactly what it said. I was like, well, I mean.
That's interesting. So if they didn't recover the bomb, or do they think he took it with him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He jumped out of the plane with the bomb.
He apparently did show it to
and
the stewardess, but she didn't know what she was looking at. Yeah. She just knew, like, there was wires and stuff inside.
It was a radio. He went to go. He jumped out and he radioed to his friend when he landed.
It could have been a radio. As long as it had a clock on it, I would be convinced.
Really, as long as there were wires in there.
Yeah. You could have just, like, packed up a bunch of, like, crap wires no one uses anymore from computers that I store in the basement.
Oh my god, red wire.
As long as there's a red wire and a blue wire, I don't know.
Yeah. But no, he jumped out. They had asked for four parachutes, which they had to get from like a skydiving school. That was the only place around that had them that they could get quickly at the airport.
Did that bother anyone else? That's the only place they can get parachutes at the airport?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Isn't that standard?
But they
can't go get them at Target. Come on.
Well, they're at an
airport.
Shouldn't they be there?
One of the ones he took was like a training one, and he didn't notice that one of them was bad, which was apparently unintentional. Or it was one that was like a tandem shoot, and he didn't notice. So they don't think that he was all that skilled with parachutes. And then he took two of them. He like held one as he jumped out. But I think he also had the bomb with him when he went and like the briefcase full of money.
That's a lot of stuff to carry. Yeah. Like as someone who like really tries to make just one trip from her car every day, regardless of how many groceries she's bringing in, that's hard.
Also, I've never gone skydiving. I know people who have.
I have.
No. How would you have done holding something in your hand the whole way down?
No.
It feels like you would need that like strapped to you or something so you don't just let go of the briefcase and like accidentally.
Yeah. Well, because like you're falling and so like your body wants to splay open because there's a lot of force moving against you with the wind and everything and, you know, gravity. And in the show, he does, like, fall backward.
Yeah.
But I know the minute I pulled the chute, well, one, you'd have to let go with one hand to pull the chute. Then that's going to, like, flip you over. I would lose it. I would drop it. Especially, like, a briefcase. Like, what the hell? Like, maybe, like, a messenger bag? But... those weren't really in style then, I think.
Yeah.
I don't buy it. Why did he want four? Like, why did he want a second one? Like, why did he take a second one? Like, what's...
I assume it probably had something to do with the... I always thought it was so that if there's three other people on the plane and you say you want four chutes, then you start thinking, well, maybe he's going to make them jump also.
Mm.
I thought it was like a confusion sort of thing.
Yeah. But then in that case, like, why take the second one with you?
Case first one doesn't go.
Yeah.
But you're already screwed at that point. Like, you're not going to be able to, like,
but he didn't know
juggle,
much about parachutes.
Juggle the bomb, juggle the money, put the
second
parachute.
Well, you could drop the bomb at that point. Like, oh, just get rid of this.
But then why take it?
Oh, I'm sorry. There were five people.
Were there two stewards?
Yeah. So when they took off again, there was Cooper, the pilot, a flight attendant, a co-pilot, and a flight engineer.
Oh.
It's a flight engineer.
You know, he takes a flight apart mid-flight and puts it back together.
And, and they did see him tie something around his waist. So maybe it was like a bag or something.
Right. I mean, he's just like duct taping $200,000 on his body. That's a, like a nice little
shove it out of his pants.
Cushion if you land hard.
Yeah, if that parachute didn't work, the money will, you know, get his fall.
Exactly. So Nate or Senior McSweeten, you know, they open the door of the plane and he gives her the money and the parachutes and everything, like Parker. And he's sweet because he's like, I'm going to get you out of here safe, I promise. And they did they did a really great job of like making it look like they were like on a runway, like the wind's blowing and it's like rainy outside. But it is a plane, and they had to have it up on blocks so they could like make it move like it was. So it's kind of dangerous.
So much of the show is just like, well, we just rounded up our crew and had them move the thing. They threw water at the thing until it looked good. Fine.
Yeah, this is actually in a factory and we green screened it to make it look like we were on the beach in Martha's Vineyard. So Cooper tells Stephanie Parker that they're going to fly to Mexico City, and he's not supposed to fly higher than 10,000 feet, flaps at 15 degrees, and if he fails these instructions, he'll know, and he'll act accordingly. So they go, and the other agent is convinced that this is all a mistake, and they're going to have to chase him all the way down the coast, and because he did tell him to fly to Mexico City, but there's not enough fuel because it burns faster at low altitudes. And Nate McSweeten Senior somehow knows a lot about this. Oh, because he ran 55 combat missions in Korea.
Ah.
And I was, because the guy's like, based on what? How would you know this? And he's like, actually.
Yeah. I got this.
I have the relevant experience. I'm gonna have to be like cutting out a lot of me just uhing and pausing. Parker's up in the cabin with the pilots and they hear something, and there's a sensor that tells you when the doors are open on a plane, which is a good sensor to have.
It's good to have.
Yeah.
And they're really proud of this scene where she like opens the door of the cabin and it's like rocking, and like the wind, there's like paper blowing everywhere, I guess like napkins.
And paper plates, which I was like, you have glass for glasses, but you save money on the paper plates? I guess she went
maybe
to Coast.
Maybe because you refill the glasses throughout the flight, but like the plates would take up a lot of space if it was real china.
Yeah. Well, but I feel like plates take up less space than glasses that don't like sit in each other.
Well, but if you're going to use the same one every time, you're like refilling a glass for people.
Yeah. So you only need the amount of glasses that there are chairs.
Right, because they're going to go through 8 bourbon and gross waters.
Okay. Yeah. Also, paper plates fly more theatrically in the air.
That's true. Maybe they just...
actual plate, that would be a problem.
Yes.
The craft services table was just really close to where they were filming, and they decided to roll with it.
That wasn't even in the script at all. It was just like, crap!
I just got sucked in. I think it would be so fun to be like watching a movie and you're like, hey, do you see that thing that just hit her? I threw that from off screen. That was me.
Like all of a sudden, like a rogue cupcake came in.
Like it's part of the scene, but you're like, but that cupcake, I remember it was chocolate with pink frosting. I hit her with a good
that would be fun
shot. She goes down towards the back of the plane, and then she sees the open door, but she doesn't see Cooper. He's gone. And then we go immediately to her trying to describe him for the police sketch artist. I guess it's just a sketch artist because it's the FBI. And she's like drawing him and like describing him.
Well, and you start to see the like really famous sketch then.
Yeah. And we find out that McSweetin Sr. was transferred back to Portland. It wasn't called a demotion, but it definitely was one. And meanwhile, Peter back at the he says that D.B. Cooper became an instant folk hero. He was a punchline on Johnny Carson. They wrote songs about him. And
a song that I've never heard of. I was like,
I think they wrote that for the episode.
What? Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was like one, which makes sense of like, then you don't have to option the music.
Oh.
Yeah.
But I think they wrote it.
I do have the sketch, and I do think it looks a little like Cary Grant.
Yeah.
As well, you could not see from,
there's a lot of glare.
Oh, there we go.
There it goes.
So McSweetin Sr. comes back to the Portland office. They're playing the D.B. Cooper song on the radio, which we think was probably written by Joe LaDuca, who does the music for Leverage. And Hardison's character is like, well, it's not my kind of music, but it, damned if it's not catchy, because his character is just there to be an antagonist. He also does a weird accent here. Let's see. We kind of see sort of a montage of, or like just moments where it's obvious that this case is going to preoccupy McSweetin for like a large part of his son's life. And, you know, he's going to be like off chasing this, leads off on this case forever. You know, like found a farm mortgage held by, you know, then we see to the present, Steve, the partner, talking about a farm mortgage paid off by a Daniel Cooper that was paid off in 1972, which was flagged, but agencies didn't share info back then, so it was never forwarded. And, you know, the best part was that he was Army Airborne Paratrooper. And then it like kind of goes back in to Nate talking to McSweetin Sr. back at his house. And Hardison's like filling him in on this stuff, and that Sophie's in route with some more info, so she'll keep him posted. And he's like, ah, I see it. Like, it's in your eye. He's hooked you now. But yeah, as part of this sort of montage you see of Senior McSweetin abandoning his family to go on leads, it's like Christmas Eve, and he's found a lead that he has to go ask somebody about. And his wife, whose name is Joy, which is great, you know,
wearing a truly horrific vest.
It's bad. And it's before like ugly sweater, Christmas sweaters were like a good thing.
Yeah.
It was just the early 70s.
Yeah. And, you know, she's like, I can't believe you're doing this test on Christmas Eve. Like, it's freaking Christmas Eve, dude. And he like has this big, like, he's so good, but he's like, if you know, as long as he's free and celebrated, other men are gonna hijack planes and people could get hurt. And it's just really sweet that he's like, this is my fault, I have to fix this. And she's like, have you seen your son's Christmas list? And she shows it to him, and he wants a bike and D.B. Cooper. Like, these are the things McSweetin Jr. wants for Christmas, and it's because he knows that's what his dad wants more than anything in the world. And he says, oh, sad. And then I'm assuming he leaves and goes anyways.
Yeah, because he's been, that one, you see him on the phone with a judge trying to get an arrest warrant or like a search warrant. And it's, the judge won't give it to him because there's no like, no eyewitness has identified him. And he's like, I know it's Christmas Eve, but I need this search warrant.
Yes.
The judge is like, it's Christmas Eve. Chill out.
Yeah. And you have no probable cause.
Yeah, why are you wasting my time?
So then he goes to
Flight
the park. Yeah.
Parker's house. Yeah. Yeah, we're back in the past. Yeah, her name is
Stephanie.
Stephanie, yeah. Ritter, oh, which her real name was Joyce something. Good job. Good job remembering. That flight attendant's real name was Joyce something or other. So they
changed it.
Yeah.
For her protection.
Especially because they named McSweeten Sr.'s wife Joy.
Yeah.
Do you think that was like a tie-in? Like maybe she did it?
Well, it does seem though that like you need to change it when you're gonna allege that like the stewardess was kind of a accessory after the fact. Like,
yeah, that's true. Like, you don't want to like besmirch her good name. And he just shows up and on Christmas Eve in the rain because it's Portland, and she, you know, he apologizes for intruding, and but she invites him in for some coffee. And he asks, like, he pulls up like a picture drawing of the sky and asks if it's the hijacker. And she's like, maybe, I don't know. And then Elliot shows up and she introduces him as her husband, Steve Reynolds. And they bring him in for the coffee and they sit and talk, and he gets to know Steve, who has gotten out of the army and hasn't been able to find work for the past 3 years or steady work.
Which I assume is because of the leisure suit that he's wearing. Probably. And the Paisley shirt.
Like maybe if he dressed a little more professionally, he would get a job.
Sir, it looks like you spend a lot of time in the morning blowing out your hair.
Yeah, you're going to be late. Yeah.
Yeah, and he has a whole bit about, you know, he was on the Tet offensive and he wanted to serve his country, but now there are crackpots hijacking planes and college students calling vets baby killers. So just he's a little dissatisfied with the way things are going. And McSweeten Sr. is like, oh, obviously this man is a man after my own heart. I'm going to hire him to be an FBI agent. That's how we do it.
Yep. No going to Quantico. Just come on in.
Yeah.
That's how federal hiring works. You just tell people.
Know somebody.
Yeah.
They does say that they are at Quantico, though, in the next scene. That he, like, went and got trained and all that sort of good stuff. And he's being sworn in.
Real quick, though, with the Christmas Eve scene, who is that? Like, I'm never at a point where I'm like, would you like some coffee? It's not brewing at night. I'm never making it for other people. It's also Christmas Eve. Why are they drinking coffee?
Maybe there was booze in it, but because they were drinking drinks earlier. That's a good point. Yeah.
Like kind of a jerk move, not being, you want to come in and have like a good cocktail? No, we'll make you coffee so you leave.
Yes, they don't want him to stay.
You're right, though. Also, like, the brewing thing is...
Yeah.
Is,
you gotta brew that.
Like,
I guess
now you could be like, I'll make you a Keurig. But...
Yeah.
In 1971, it took a little longer. Yeah.
Would you like to come in and make awkward small talk for 10 minutes before
we... While this brews? And then later you're gonna have to use my toilet? Please. No.
It was 1971. They had instant coffee then. This is just some, like, Nescafe granules.
Oh, or it is so bad. What was left over from the pot that morning.
Oh god, it was like a solid at that point.
But I mean, I do appreciate that she didn't offer him alcohol because he was going to drive home afterward and it was wet and rainy out there. So maybe she just wanted him to be safe and alert.
Could have gone with tea though, because I feel like you want a cup of tea.
Hot cocoa. Quick.
It's very classy, the tea.
Yeah.
I also really like when they are making him an FBI agent, that he explains that because of undercover work, he doesn't have to cut his hair. But then they're like, one for Mr. Hoover. And they both turn like very stony faced to take pictures. It's and so good. I love the shorthand of one for Mr. Hoover, meaning like have no expression on your face whatsoever.
Something that we'll see when it comes back to the another flashback of this flashback scene is that they have two fireplaces in this house. There's like one in the living room, but there's also one in the dining room kitchen area where they're having their drink talking. Yeah, this is a very fancy 1970s house, right? And of course, both of them are lit.
Lit AF.
What if it's just like the wall, like it goes through?
Oh, it could be that.
Yeah.
The one on either side. I love those. It's like so double fancy. This, you know, two for one. So Steve becomes McSweeten Sr.'s partner and
this is so good.
He had an ally in his quest to bring D.B. Cooper to justice. And Hardison, back in the present at Leverage HQ, asks, like, did you ever think you'd end up in the FBI? And he's like, after what I went through in the war, I didn't think I'd live this long. But, you know, it's fair to say that the day Peter McSweeten knocked on my door, he saved my life. And then we go back to the past. So there have been suspects. They found, a family found some cash from the Cooper ransom that was like washed up on a riverbank, and they go to investigate, and Hardison's character is there and he's a jerk, and Elliot's character Steve like tries to beat him up, and
he gets a little intense.
It does, in the woods. Like,
my wife still has nightmares, but like really up in his face.
Yeah, like, how dare you. And
that's the last we see of Hardison's flashback character.
Yeah.
Yes, they're like, he's a jerk, goodbye. We don't need you anymore.
Left in the woods.
Yeah. Well, and he does say, like, what did you expect to find out here? You know, that, like, him living in a log cabin. No, he died, or he walked out. Like, he's not going to be in these woods.
Obviously, that was a reference to Without a Paddle.
Obviously.
Yeah. Where they find him in a cabin in the woods?
No, they find his partner.
They find his partner, but still.
Spoilers for
those of you that haven't seen this movie.
Is that legit a storyline in Without a Paddle?
They find that's the whole point of the story, is that they are going in to try to find D.B. Cooper's money.
Did you just think I was making this obscure reference for nothing?
Yes, I did.
No, they're like, childhood friend dies, and they're like, we're gonna go find, he loved D.B. Cooper, we're gonna go solve the mystery for our friend. It's like the First Wives Club, but with early 20s.
And less like divorce and revenge.
And so then they find D.B. Cooper's partner. And I think, don't they find D.B. Cooper's body,
his dead,
like,
body
hanging from a tree because of the parachute?
Yeah.
Like, where he died?
Well, like, and his partner carries the bones away at the end. Like, him and he's going to go do it together. Yeah.
Go do what together?
Well, they're just going to keep going off together, like him and the dead body.
It's fine.
Yes.
It works in the context.
Oh, they're those kind of partners. Okay.
You know, it doesn't,
But yeah, they definitely find D.B. Cooper's dead body hanging from a tree. Which they do not do in Leverage, which is good, because that would really...
Would it change the vibe?
Yeah, there's not a lot of dead bodies on Leverage.
No.
With them. So I but this like last line from Hardison's character, like, you're not gonna find him, it's another file for the cold case room, and then he like dramatically walks off into the woods where they're all gonna have to like meet up together to drive back together, you assume. But it's kind of like this turn of a page for McSweeten Senior, because Steve tells him, like, don't listen to him, and he's like, you know, we might never find him, but we could still do some good in this world. So then you get another montage,
the best montage ever, maybe.
Oh, possibly
better than anything else. Certainly the best Leverage montage.
You know, you get the car pulling up, you like, you get Elliot chasing a bad guy, like bow duking across the hood of this car.
Which Nate is driving.
Nate is driving the car. And Timothy Hutton is driving that car. These are both the actors doing this stunt. John Rogers was not psyched.
You would think that, like, it would have been easier if he stopped the car and just let him continue driving, like, continue running instead of, let me use this car.
Yeah.
But not nearly as cool.
Wouldn't have been as cool. Would not
and
have
he's
been.
Wearing polyester pants, so they're really slippery. So you're going to get a good boost of speed coming off the hood.
Too true.
It's like in Mario Kart when you, like, shake your controller as you're going up the ramp and then you just do a little flip in the air.
Yeah.
The trick. Probably my favorite part is when they're doing, like, a sting operation in the montage and the like, crooked FBI agent is, like, selling him cocaine and he, like, goes to taste it.
Oh, yeah.
But McSween, like, shoots him first and he's like, what are you doing? I was finishing the job. And he's like, no, he's not just a crooked FBI agent.
You can do it.
I believe in you.
Psychopath too, because it's not heroin, it's cyanide.
You guys, you don't know how hard she's laughing and how hard it was to get that sentence out. He's also a serial cop killer, not just a drug dealer.
We thought he was just a dirty narcotics detective. Turns out he's a psychopath. Oh my gosh.
That's a lot of cyanide.
I know. But here's my theory on this 0.5 second scene. Is that you only need to get that much cyanide once because you can reuse it every time you kill somebody.
Well, now he's got a hole in it. He got to really close that up again.
You don't want that to get around.
Maybe it's just a little cyanide mixed with a lot of cocaine.
Oh.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know in 1971 or 2 if cyanide was cheaper than cocaine. I have no idea.
I don't know if it's cheaper
and
now.
And I'm not Googling that.
Is that something that we should Google? I don't know.
I guess I could Google it and then an FBI agent might contact me and I could just ask them.
Yes. I mean, our personal FBI agents are probably listening right now.
Guys, could you chime in, please?
DM me.
They're just sitting around also drinking wine. Like, dude, we don't know the answer to that.
How old do you think we are?
And like, I know that the files aren't digitized. Please go and find out.
It's a really sore subject for us.
Then they have another one where they're chasing a bad guy and Steve is like running across a roof and like McSween Sr. is like trying to tell the guy, you're not a cop killer. Like, I know what you're going through. He's like just trying to talk him down. But Steve like punches him and they're going to take the guy and they go back to his car and they're like, what's in the trunk? And they open it up and it's the girl that they talked to earlier. And Steve accuses McSween Sr. of like thinking the best of people. Like, you think too much of people. And which is fair.
Yeah. You know?
And ironic. Let's see what else. Oh, Sophie has located this Daniel Cooper that they had the lead on, and he's been dead since 1968, 3 years before the hijacking. He died in Vietnam, which is why Hardison couldn't find the death certificate. So there's another, among all of the dead ends, another dead end. So I love this, how they kind of did this next scene. They're back at Leverage headquarters and it's Nathan Hardison. We're at the part that I'm talking about. Never mind. Back at Leverage headquarters, they are, you know, still looking at the case and Hardison's like, it's not what's here, it's what's missing. Like, you know, we were talking about earlier, there's no DNA evidence, even though they pulled hairs and fibers from the hijacker's clothing. And Steve's like, yeah, I mean, I retired before all that stuff was important. But I know where it must be stored, the crime lab. And so they've got to go get this out of this crime lab somewhere. And they're in Parker's guy, Lucille, and McSweeten Jr. And he's like amazed at all of their high tech stuff, which he's like, we don't get any of this. What a laser.
I cannot believe they let McSweeten into Lucille. And then they leave him alone in there.
Yes.
He's never alone in that van. I bet Hardison's in there somewhere.
Crouched.
Yeah.
Deeply.
But he's like, oh, this is so cool. Can I play with this? And Parker, we don't even see her steal it. Like, we just see her come back with a box. Right?
Well, yeah. It was probably a pretty tight budget.
Yeah.
For the show.
We're running out of time.
Yeah, we all know what Parker's heists look like.
Yeah, she's so fast.
We already saw one break in. We don't need to.
Yeah, it's similar. She wore the same mask.
Yeah.
But this time she's a brunette.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and inside Miss Sweden's like, I asked the Bureau for a desk lamp 6 months ago. Is that a crossbow? And she's like, don't touch that. You know, then she jumps in and they take off. And Nate back talking with, in the present, Nate, who's still talking to McSweeten Sr., asks him if he has any regrets about the case. And he says he's only had one, and it's that his son had a hard time growing up in the shadow of D.B. Cooper, which I think is really sweet and kind of sad. And then we flip back to the past again, where McSweeten Sr. has gotten a lead. There was an eyewitness 8 years after the hijacking, who's a kid who was on the plane, who thinks that they got the composite sketch, the police, you know, sketch wrong. And he had been on the plane, he says, and he swears that that guy looks differently. So they got to go follow this lead. But just as they're about to head out, they get a call from baby Todd, baby Junior McSweeten. Mm-hmm. And he's, which I like, he's like, this is the first solid lead I've had in a while, but my son needs me and I'm going to go see my son. And I'm going to send off the partner that I trust to follow this lead.
Yeah, he's got to dad it up.
Yeah, which is wonderful. And
hold on, I have two things to say about this really quickly. One is that they have a picture of Jimmy Carter on the back wall during the scene, which I thought was a really clever way of like showing how much time had passed. Mm-hmm. That like we are now not in the early 70s anymore.
But you don't think they were just fans of his peanut farm?
I mean, yeah, everyone's a fan of his peanut farm, right? So who doesn't love him for his peanuts and his Habitats for Humanity?
Ugh.
But the other thing is that, so I was rewatching this episode and I hadn't watched it in a couple of years, and you don't ever see the scene where like Steve is talking to the eyewitness boy. Like you see him meet the boy, but you don't see him actually like talking to him about D.B. Cooper. And in like a weird Mandela effect, I swear I've seen that scene.
Oh,
like maybe I've seen just enough scenes like that in other procedurals, right? That like I filled it in with some combination of like bones and numbers and Criminal Minds.
Yeah.
But like, I really feel like I've seen the scene of Christian Kane talking to a boy about like, or like to a young man about what he saw when he was a boy and leading him away from like making him doubt what it is he saw. And I don't know what, maybe I like somehow saw an extended episode of it at some point or like saw it on YouTube or something, but
you were in the Fringe universe and
you've written this extension. Yeah,
which if somehow I managed to like go into the Fringe universe and just see that scene and not somehow like the second season of Firefly, I'm gonna be kind of pissed, but
fair. Maybe you read a fanfic.
No, I have like a visual memory of this.
It's weird. That is very weird.
Yeah, I don't know.
But in the real episode,
not in Robin's crazy head,
Miss Wheaton Senior like goes to meet up with Todd, who's kind of just standing on the side of the road, well, on like a sidewalk, not like on the highway. And he tells his dad that a bunch of kids said that they needed to borrow his bike to go look for a lost dog. And that they said that they would be right back, but that was 3 hours ago. And then he says, why does this keep happening to me?
Poor little cinnamon roll of a child.
I know. And McSween Senior says, you know, every day I go and chase bad guys, some of them are really bad. And pretty soon you start to see everyone like that. It's easier that way. You know, you could be like that too, and you wouldn't lose as many bikes. And then he said, the little McSweeten says, but I wouldn't find any dogs. Aww. And you're just like, oh no.
And then like all of the times that he's been this like weird bumbling guy as an adult makes so much more sense.
Yeah. And you know, you're like, it was good that even though like we kind of took advantage of him, that they did help him and like boost him up, because there's a lot of people who have failed up who shouldn't have failed up. And I think this is a good person to have failed up, you know? And also like that's this kind of refrain that's come back in season 4 and in season 5, that like, when you chase bad guys and you take bad guys down every day, you start to think that way, and that affects how you are. And that's kind of been like what Nate's been saying to everybody, and this is like the antidote of that, right? Like, this is the, yeah, but I could go the other way too. It could just make me kinder, you know?
Oh, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that.
I have some good points sometimes. It's really exciting. There was when it.
Yeah. Hey, you have good points often.
Thanks.
So I would, much. In fact, say you have good points usually.
And McSweeten goes on. McSweeten Senior says, "Yeah, he's like, that's right." Which is also like his thing is the, you know, we should see the best in people and try to help people. And he tells him it's not a weakness to see the good in people. It's not a flaw or a bad thing to do to trust. And then he says, "Do you want to know the truth, Todd? You're the best guy I know."
Aww.
And then he probably took him to get ice cream or something. And then he says, in the present, he says, I still believe that my son is the best guy I know. And he says, back in the present too, that all the people that he arrested, that they were all human beings to him, and that something drove them to cross that line. But I always believed that they could be redeemed, even D.B. Cooper.
That does go very slightly against the shooting the serial cop killer with the bag full of cyanide, but
he only did that to save his partner's life,
right? But I'm just saying that.
I think he just winged him. I don't think he shot him in the head. Like,
okay, I'm pretty sure he killed him, but
I mean, he didn't say he wouldn't kill him. He just said he saw them as humans.
Maybe he'd already tried to redeem that guy.
Yeah. No, but I think that saving his partner from dying.
Yeah. No, I know. I'm just saying it's a little.
It's fine. No one's perfect, especially FBI agents. And Nate tells him, like, I can't believe that people can be redeemed. But then, you know, he says, then you can see why I'm worried about my son, because he could just be consumed by this hunt and always be wanting to like avenge my defeats. And then it goes back to this Odyssey parallel of Telemachus and Odysseus and the McSweetens. And McSweeten Senior says, like, you don't have to find D.B. Cooper. He's lost somewhere, but you just have to make sure that my son doesn't follow him out there into the darkness. friends. And then Nate's like, well, it's getting late. Until tomorrow. And Peter McSween Sr. says, I'll be here. And you're like, oh, not if you say that, you're not.
Oh, no, sir. Now you need to die. Now you're going to die.
Yes. Those are the rules. I didn't make them, but that's how it works. And then back at Leverage headquarters. Oh, sad. So Nate asks, like, how, what the DNA file is like. And we find that the DNA never made it to the main case file because it was contaminated by the investigating team. Everybody's DNA is in there. Cooper's, Reynolds, McSweeten's, the lab techs, everybody's. Which is what he was afraid of, which is what happens when old cases, to old cases when they predate modern forensics.
By the way, that's actually true. They did find DNA from, because they have DB Cooper's tie. Mm-hmm. And they have found DNA on it, but they have no way of knowing whose DNA that actually is.
Because it was a clip also... on.
What? Yeah. Well, but they don't have samples from all the people who, like, work, you know, they didn't keep track of all that. Yeah. And so you have to imagine that since it was a clip on, every lab tech, like, tried it on.
Oh, for sure.
Apparently it also had high levels of titanium on it, which they're like, he must have had a job where he worked with titanium. Like, he was at an airport. That feels like, you know.
Is titanium something that's in the air at airports?
Well, I just mean that, like, that's a lot of metal. Like, I don't know. That feels like, oh, he must have worn this at a job where he was a machinist or something. Feels like kind of a stretch.
Yeah. Not a lot of machinists wear ties.
Right.
I feel like that's a hazard, which is probably why it was a clip-on, though.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Gosh, you've thought of it.
I got it.
It's yeah.
Done. We solved it, y'all.
Now we're back to the drawing board, which Nate says is more hopeful than square one. But then Parker gets a call from McSweeten Jr. and finds out that his dad died in the night, which is very sad. And then in the brew pub, yeah, McSweeten, I guess he's the only McSweeten left. He's the last one standing. He's like, we should be drinking coffee, but they're instead, Nate is pouring shots. But McSweeten says, because his dad loved coffee. Maybe Stephanie knew that, and that's why she offered him coffee.
Yes. Old cold coffee, because that was his favorite.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Only like a third of a glass full.
We hopped up with hot water from the tap.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have microwaves yet.
Nope.
And Steve is there, and they talk about, he like shares a memory about him, or several memories. And excuse you.
So he shares a memory because Parker asks him, like, they're all sitting around drinking at the table, and she's mm-hmm. like, tell me a memory of this, which felt very much like that was something that Sophie would have said. That mm-hmm. seemed like a lot of insight and like good.
She already been cut out of this episode though.
Yeah, right. No, it really feels like
Gina had already
like,
home.
Yeah, we don't want to make Gina Bellman show up just for this one scene. Like, yeah, we'll just give her a line to Parker. It's fine.
Yeah, that's true. That is really true. Yeah, and we learned he was a hell of a shot, but a terrible driver.
Which is funny. It showed when he almost drove into...
Yes!
Yeah.
There we go.
Answers your question of why didn't he just stop? Because
He was that bad. I thought he was trying to. He just kept hitting it, but he didn't hit the brake. He just kept hitting the accelerator.
Oh, just so confused by the clutch versus brake situation.
His partner's constantly. Like, gosh, dang it. I'm going to have to jump over this car again.
Flooding engines all the time.
Next time I'm driving.
Yeah. And McSweeten says, you know, I want to thank you all for trying, but from now on, the hunt for DB Cooper is on me. And later at Leverage headquarters, Parker finds Nate and she asks him what he's doing. And he says, you know, he's fulfilling what McSweeten Sr. asked him to do to make sure that this doesn't consume his son. So he says, you know, I'm not going to let that happen. And then it's like, I'm probably in the middle of the night because Nate and Hardison are kind of pacing and talking this out. So we go back to the fact that there was the passenger who came forward who had said that the sketch was wrong, but he only remembered it like 8 years later. And you know, he saw him for what, 10 seconds. And the stewardess, she was sitting right next to him on the flight for 5 hours. So she studied every inch of his face. And they have like this is the scene that I was talking about earlier. They have just like the sketch, just like lots of little thumbnails of the sketch on this projected screen that Hardison has up. And it just looks visually really neat. But yeah, so like all of this stuff, you know, there's hundreds of suspects. We don't know if he survived this jump. The only thing that they really have for certain is this sketch. And that's the only thing that no one has ever questioned. And I think this is a really fun way to like come at this mystery that everybody has studied for so long, that he's like, wait, where was she sitting? And then he asks makes about
quite the deductive leap though.
He does.
And so I don't
blame the victim.
What?
I just like a blame the victim. She got it wrong. As soon as I mean, she did, but that was this story.
Yeah.
Well, no, I agree. It just felt like very like, oh, well, what if she was wrong? Like, okay, what would that mean? They're like, oh, well, clearly that means the in-flight magazine. And I get that they were like coming up on the end of the episode and you need to wrap it up. But it seemed like there needed to be one or two more steps in that deductive reasoning chain. Like, well, why would she have lied? Well, you know, where would she have gotten this description? Who could she have been describing? And then just like, oh, of course, the in-flight magazine. That's the only other place you would see a face on a plane.
Why didn't they call that cigarette man in?
Yeah.
I mean, he was in every magazine. He was obviously familiar with the plane.
Yeah. Did no one else like who worked? Yeah. No pilot looked at that and was like, hey, that looks like
September.
Maybe if it hadn't been on the back of the magazine, if he had been like looking through crime scene photos of the plane and maybe saw like that it was open to a picture of Cary Grant or something, like that would have worked.
And just North by Northwest is playing in the back.
That was the in-flight movie.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just think it was like interesting. Like, okay, if you're sitting forward looking on a plane and somebody's talking to you and you're trying to describe something and you don't want to come up with something straight out of your mind, like what are you looking at? The only thing in front of you that could have a picture on it would be the in-flight magazine.
Even if he had explained it that way, if you'd had him like explaining it out loud, how he got to that conclusion. But he's like, that's the one thing nobody's ever questioned. What if she lied? Pull up a picture of the plane. What was the in-flight? What was on the back of the in-flight magazine?
Don't they have like a flashback of her sitting there with the sketch artist and she's like sitting there like.
Yes, but they couldn't see the sketch.
That's true. Like,
it's just. It's
they were
so
trying to show don't tell. How,
they just need to out of the stretch plane. That out like a little bit more. Like 5 more seconds of Nate thinking and I would have bought it.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they have taken her to like police headquarters to talk to the sketch artist? Been like, no, you've already been traumatized in this plane enough.
It's fresh in your mind. We can't let you sleep.
We got the sketch artist here.
Yeah.
I think in this era they still didn't have a lot of like procedures for things.
Or like I think understand it was like how trauma affected the brain.
Crime is committed. Try and solve it. Like that was the procedure. Try and solve it.
Do whatever you need to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I do think that there is this leap here. Well, I guess like once you realize, hey, she lied about the sketch and the husband of her husband also was looking for DB Cooper, like, okay, maybe then we're gonna be like, well, let's go ask this guy some questions, because Nate shows up at Steve's house and is like, oh, you know, I was in the neighborhood, I had a couple questions I wanted to run by you. And he picks up this picture of Stephanie and says, you know, she was beautiful. And Steve tells her that she's been gone for 10 years. And Steve's like, oh, I'm going to go make some tea. So now he can make tea.
And this is the time when saying I'm going to go make coffee would make more sense, because that buys you more time.
Yeah. And so he walks out and, you know, Nate gives him a few seconds, and then you see Steve come back behind him. He has like a suitcase and a gun in his hand, and Nate like knows that he's there, and he's like, oh, you got married in 1972, right? And McSweeten also comes in the door at that moment. He's like, Uncle Steve, why do you have a gun?
I know. And why is the kettle still going off? Did we get that tea?
And where is Elliot? You are going to go confront the man who you think is one of the most notorious criminals?
I think it's like a time travel thing where you can't meet your old self.
Oh, okay. That explains it. I'll allow that. That makes perfect sense. Yeah. Because literally, though, like, you have a hitter. This is why you have a hitter.
Backup of any kind.
Bring your hitter when confronting anyone who's ever been on the FBI most wanted list. Then you bring your hitter.
These are excellent points. And they should be made.
I think that, the time travel thing is maybe he did bring him and then he just temporarily blipped out of existence.
Yeah. That is a loophole that happens.
I hate when that happens, honestly. And Nate says, you know, why don't you tell us the real story of D.B. Cooper? So then we get the flashback again. And we see, you know, that it's Elliot, not D.B. Cooper, it's Christian Kane, not the first guy that we saw. And we like the scene where he's like asking Parker, the stewardess, like, oh, are you afraid? And he's like, do I look crazy to you? Then it kind of, because it's Elliot, seems a lot sweeter. Yeah.
Let me take off my hat.
Yeah, obviously, like, that's... look at me, I'm not crazy. She's like, okay, I believe you.
I know, but you don't look like Cary Grant either.
Ugh. Yeah,
nobody has such a good blowout that it's fine.
She's like, you have to survive this because you have to tell me who your hairdresser is.
Yeah, I got to know what you use in your hair. The volume,
please drop that hair, Caroline. And then we get like this extended scene of when she goes to see what happened when the aft door opened, and she actually finds him before he jumps, and she's like, no, don't do it. And he tells her that he has to go do it.
He explains why he's doing it.
Yes. And it is connected to that grave that Sophie went to see. It was his friend who died in the war, and he promised that he'd take care of his family. So he's stealing this money to give to his family. And then he still jumps out of the plane holding something in front of him. Was it the bomb? Was it the money? Was it the parachute?
Who could say?
No. It was all three. But
it is the way they did this. So it's a really good looking stunt, right? Like the door opens and it's Christian Kane leaping out into like a rainy, cloudy sky. And the way they did it was they just suspended the door 20 feet up above a bunch of mats with hoses and fans. And Christian Kane leapt out backwards and was attached to a rope. And there were a couple of grips holding onto the rope who just like yeeted him backwards as soon as he jumped out. And the first time he did it, he missed the mats and still got up and was like, I think I can do a better take. Let's do this again. But like, that's a full-on practical effect of just like man attached to ropes, and as soon as he jumped out, they just pulled him sideways so it would look like he got whipped away by the wind.
He's a maniac.
He is a Batman, I think.
Are they looking for a new Batman?
No, they have one. It's Robert Pattinson.
I'm not sold on that.
And so then like the next scene is her at her house, like at night in the rain, and she sees him outside her kitchen window.
Well, when he jumped out, he said, like, don't worry, you'll see me again.
Yeah.
Yes, but haunting like you from your kitchen window. Like,
yeah, like, we knocked on like, a my girl's number door. One
fear. Yeah.
Yes. But, like, you just, like, look email. Out.
Like, call her.
But maybe yeah. her phone number was unlisted. She was probably
yes, but her address wasn't?
Maybe he saw her ID. Changed
addresses, but not, like, phone
knock numbers. On her door. Oh, like, and if you want to be, like, discreet, like, knock on the back door, but, like,
no,
just, like, looking up from washing dishes, and then, you know, when it's dark outside, and you could just really see your reflection, and then you look past your reflection, and you're like, oh,
yeah.
And she doesn't jump, she's just, like,
into my nightmare, yeah.
She's like, oh, okay, and just, like, goes outside, and there he is. Then they make out, which I'm like, you know, Beth is just, you know, she gets to make out with Alice, she gets to make out with Christian. She's just like, she's winning. He's still got the briefcase. But no money in it, I guess.
That could have been the bomb.
Why would you keep that evidence?
Maybe it's a different briefcase.
Maybe. But it says, like, in the transcript, it's like, she goes to the backyard to meet him. He's carrying the briefcase he jumped from the plane with. But drops it on the ground before touching her face and pulling her close. And then they have this picture of their wedding, a photo from the wedding, but it looks like it's like prom. And then it goes to Christmas. And this is the scene that we saw earlier, but from their perspective, when Miss Wheaton Sr. shows up and they are, after he leaves, Steve is convinced that he's taunting him because he knows that he's D.B. Cooper. And she's like, he's not, like, he's, maybe he's not, maybe he's telling the truth. I mean, like, why would he come here and do that? Like, you could just leave, you could run now. And she's the one who convinces him. Like, she's like, I think you should help him try to find D.B. Cooper. But that he's going to have to be on the top of his game because there's like one slip up and it's over. But yeah, and we find out that the money paid for a dairy farm for Dan Cooper's family, and he buried some of it in the woods in case he got caught, which is what the campers found. And Nate's like, you know, there's one thing I couldn't figure out, like the kid that was the witness on the plane, like how did that fall through? And how did you fool him? And Steve's like, well, years of lying, like 40 years of lying has taught me. All you have to do is like look someone in the eye and they won't know, you know, that the truth is looking right back at them, I guess. So McSweeten is like, all right, you're going to jail. Case closed, handcuffs him, is taking this old man out of the house. And Nate stops him and, you know, McSweeten's like, he's a criminal, he belongs in jail. And Nate's like, well, I don't think all criminals belong in jail, but okay. And yes. He says, you know,
crime is bad.
Yes.
Yes.
Stealing is wrong?
bad man
Nate, who definitely killed two men in the last season, you know, he's like, your dad had a gift that I believe he passed on to you, that he could see goodness in people, and because of that he did bring D.B. Cooper to justice. And you're like, oh, he made him a good upstanding citizen who made the world a better place. Okay. And you know, you get another flashback to, you know, at the Portland office, helping people, getting the woman out of the trunk of a car, and you know, doing all their good stuff that they did.
And I know this is camp because of budgeting reasons, but I really wish that these flashbacks had been all new ones. Like that they were cuts to different cases that we hadn't seen.
Yeah. That's true. And then we get the repeat of Steve saying, you know, it's fair to say that him knocking on that door saved my life. And so he lets him go. So sweet. And then we see McSweeten like go back to the house and go over to his dad's chair and pick up his copy of the Odyssey. And he opens it up and he sees the bookmark is his Christmas list from all those years ago. You're like, oh.
Oh, and then he does the little tally-ho gesture again.
Yes.
Ow.
Yeah. And then they go back to the pub and he's sitting with Nate, and Nate tells him that he did the right thing. And he wonders, do you think my dad knew? And Nate's like, you know, the thing is, he believed that Steve Reynolds was a man who needed a second chance. And isn't that enough? And I'm like, Nate, if this had been you, if you had been in this man's shoe, it would not have been enough for you. Not at
all. It's such a non-answer.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Do you think my dad knew? Unrelated statement.
Right. It's like what you tell a little kid, you know, when you don't want to fully answer their question.
Santa lives in all of our hearts.
And isn't that what's important here? Yeah. And Sophie, you know, Miss Sweden's like, my father went on an odyssey for over 40 years and you ended it. And he like leaves him the book because he knows his dad would want him to have it. And Sophie is like, oh, hey, I haven't been in this episode in 40 minutes, so I'm going to come in. And he asks her, like, she's like, I hope this doesn't mean you're going back to sea when she sees the book. And he asks her, like, if you could choose someone from the Odyssey, who do you think I would be? And she's like, well, Odysseus, obviously, because you're my love interest and you're the hero in the story, I guess. But yeah, she says cunning warrior, master disguise, and it means trouble in Greek. And Nate's like, I think I'm a siren. I think I draw people to their depths.
He's a beautiful woman.
Yeah.
And he's the most melodramatic.
Well, I mean, he's also near, I mean, they were in Seattle. That's the Starbucks symbol.
It's true. But, you know, he says he has the song that offers sailors their deepest desire, right? Which is what the whole shtick of leverage is that you take people down by using what they want the most to screw them over. So, like, you know, their deepest desires, and then you use that to destroy them. And he says, you know, when we first started this thing, do you remember what I said to everybody? You all know what you can do, but I know what you can do together. And he's like, that's my talent. But now, you know, it's back to that, like, when you spend all your time delving into, like, these minds of these evil people and with all their flaws and their weaknesses, or looking for them, then it's all you can see in everyone. And so he's like, well, that's not what happened to McSweeten Sr. And he says, ah, but McSweeten wasn't Jimmy Ford's son. Yeah, I kind of screwed you over there.
Yeah.
And then she says, so what do you want to do? And he says, I want to build something. And this is, speaking of building, it's like building on the sort of mystery of this season. It's like, what is Nate up to? He was planning something at the beginning of the season with Hardison and like the bowels of Leverage HQ. And like, what is it? What's it going to be?
Why are we in Portland?
I honestly don't remember.
I'm excited. Stay tuned to find out.
I know. Robin and I are going to talk about another episode this weekend.
That's how you're going to sell that?
I know. I got to go watch it.
Yeah, me too. So yeah, that is the DB Cooper job. Any last thoughts on it?
I have a couple of little things, but I don't want to stomp on y'all's toes if you have stuff.
Nope. I think I'm out. I don't remember anything else.
I assume you're going to cut the earlier part where we talked about this, but the two things I wanted to say about DB Cooper are that there was an early fan theory
for Mad Men fans that Don Draper would end up being D.B. Cooper, which is great and clearly not what ended up happening, but would have been an amazing end to that show. Had they not wanted to go the Coke commercial route, D.B. Cooper would also have played really well, I think, if they could have built to it. Also, in the Loki fan trailer, the Loki trailer, if you are a fan of Marvel stuff, there is going to be a Loki show this summer. And in the trailer, Loki is D.B. Cooper. You can see Tom Hiddleston dressed up like him, and he jumps out of a plane, and like the Rainbow Bridge swoops down and grabs him as he's jumping out. So it remains to be seen if that's like a quick part of a montage or a big plot point. But it looks like canonically in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Loki was D.B. Cooper, which is so cool. As far as the Odyssey goes, if anyone is a fan of the Odyssey and has not read Circe yet, it is very much worth reading.
So good.
And if
I
you're
in my Audible book,
the audio book's really good of it.
I know, but I just haven't had a chance to sit down for like 20 hours yet.
It's very good. It's not dense. Like it's not breezy, but like I read it, but it was very readable. It wasn't work to read. And he has is it Song of Achilles or?
Yeah.
Her first one about Achilles is also lovely. And I think as nice a retelling as you can do of Achilles and Patroclus as a love story. But if you're into sirens, it's great.
I know everyone says, I'm like, but I know how it ends. And they're like, yeah, but.
No. But it ends so sweet. Yeah. Like I know it's not a tragedy the way she tells
that's
it.
Wild to me. Yeah, so I need to read that one.
But if you're into sirens, Margaret Atwood has a great poem called Siren Song about being a siren. And when Nate said his thing about being a siren, it made me think of it. I'm not going to read the poem because it is long, but at the end it's about like, do you want to know what siren songs are? And at the end it is, come closer, this song is a cry for help. Help me, only you can, you are unique. At last, alas, it is a boring song, but it works every time.
Ooh.
And at that, ooh. I felt like really, like that's what Nate and them do, is to be like, no, you are unique. You can, only you can solve this problem to the mark. And that's how they win every time. So,
every time.
Margaret Atwood's poem knows what's up.
She knows.
So that's, the poetry corner. It's our poetry corner.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
I love it. I feel like I did have a high slight saved. Jen, do you have a high slight or any last thoughts on the episode?
I mean, I had a thought of the Odyssey as soon as that brought up. I was like, oh, I just was reading about this. You know, like a Polyphemus.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that they were purple?
Really?
Purple? No.
Yeah. That's all I have on it. I mean, it didn't make their milk purple or anything. I don't know about that. It could have. But yeah, just a translation error. I mean, they were sheep done by a cyclops. Of course, they were interesting. But
yeah.
They were also purple.
That's cool.
Wait, so just the sheep were purple?
Just the sheep were purple.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought you were saying Polyphemus was purple.
Wait, are you saying that it was in the original giant purple Greek people eater purple, or like someone translated Greek. It wrong? Okay, because that makes sense sort of, because like purple dye was so expensive.
Yes.
And so like
you didn't even have to dye it because it was already
right, like that would be like sheep. Super magical special sheep if their wool was already purple and you didn't have to farm thousands and thousands of tiny little ocean animals to get like a drop of purple dye.
And that would explain why he was so paranoid about people coming to steal them, because they probably were trying to come and steal them all the time.
Yeah.
Suddenly this is a sympathetic character. there is a my quick little high slight, which doesn't actually have much to do with this subject for this one, which we try to do, but it came across something I was reading the other day. And there is a documentary on YouTube called Miami Sting, The Art of the Heist. And I only watched part of it because it was what was linked in this post that I read. But the FBI gets this like art historian professor to come in and help them verify that this piece, I believe it was a Rubens, was authentic. And when they got him to go undercover with them, they were like, okay, like, you don't say anything because these people will get really shifty really fast and we don't want to spook them. So when you see it, if you think it's real, just nod your head or shake your head if you think it's fake. And this guy was like, no. And he like pulls it out and he's like, first of all, and they have like a really bad recreation of it because this documentary from like the 90s. And he's like, first of all, I got onto them right away because it was like wrapped up in a paper bag. And this is like a like an actual like small Rubens painting. And he was like, this should be in bubble wrap. This is not handled properly. And
no, then, a paper bag is usually what a Rubens sandwich is in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
got it wrong.
And then he like pulled it out and he just like started lecturing and he was like, it was great because I haven't lectured on Rubens in a couple years. And it was like, I had a captive audience. And he was like, and then I thought I would have a little fun and say, wow, this is like the best Rubens I've ever seen outside of a museum, knowing that they had stolen it from a museum. And then he asked the woman who was passing it off, like, where did you get it? And she just like smiled and was like, oh, an inheritance. And the FBI agent's like sitting next to him, like just sweating bullets, like, stop it. So I highly recommend watching this art professor talk about this. The documentary is called The Miami Sting, The Art of the Heist. Fascinating. I need to go back and watch all of it. But yeah, that's my highlight. So thank you so much, Robin and Jen, for coming on you know, finally coming on and doing this. And, you know, next time we won't push it back 3 weeks. Knock on wood.
In the event of more insurrections.
It won't happen. It's butterflies.
No. Knock on wood. But yeah, so you won't see us again. Wait. Neither of y'all are like super on social media. This is usually when I'm like, where can people find you on the internet? You can find me on Twitter at LibrariansD. And if you have anything you want to say to Jen or Robin, tell me there and I will pass it along. And you won't see us again, but you'll hear us again next week. I promise Robin and I are going to be talking about the real fake car job.
Ooh.
Fake real car job? The real fake
car job. Yes. Yeah, it's great. It's got Matthew Lillard. It's got the mob.
I have literally forgotten.
I'm always like on the car episodes, which is tough because I don't know that much about cars.
I know, but Matthew Lillard, again, is in Without a Paddle.
I know. You brought that up earlier, and I was like, why would I? I forgot that Matthew Lillard was on this.
Yes.
I'm the perfect person to have this podcast. Yes. So, yes. And this is where we say goodbye. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye.
We didn't talk about any leverage news.
Oh, yeah.
A few things. Beth Riescraff and Gina Bellman have been really cute, like, tweeting at each other this past week. Just, like, Beth Riescraff, like, sitting in Sophie's, like, director chair. And then Gina Bellman put, like, an octopus in Beth's. And it was just, like, cute back and forth. Beth Riescraff also posted a picture of her and Gina Bellman and the new actress who's playing the new character, Hardison's
sister.
Yeah, sister. And they're like masked up. And aww, it's like a sister, little sister, big sister, and a Parker. and that they look so cute and happy. What else? Oh, Christian Kane's dad died.
No, of COVID,
passed
right?
away of COVID, yeah. So that was really, awful. Really sad. And it was like right
the day after Christmas.
Day after Christmas. Like, and he like hadn't even left the house. And he still got it. So that was just heartbreaking to hear. And Beth Rieschkopf was also posting a lot of stuff about UFC Fight Night, which I guess happened recently, which there was a Leverage episode that had to do with UFC fighting. So, but
I really wish that they would announce like a date.
I would love that. Or and they did, like a general... they did release another picture, like an official picture of all of them, including Noah Wiley, on a website. I can't remember who.
I would like something, even if it was like summer 2021 or fall 2021.
Yeah, I agree. Come on, IMDb TV. Come on.
Yeah, come on. I'm watching Mad Men on you. I'm watching your ads.
Speaking of IMDb TV, Almost Paradise is going to be on there.
Oh, good. All right.
Excellent. So, I mean, it was on
Dean Devlin's streaming
app. Thank you. It was on Dean Devlin's app, which is a great app. It's fine. I think it'll be easier to watch on IMDb TV, though.
Yeah.
I think more people will watch it that way.
Well, so you can just get to that through Amazon Prime, which is super, makes it super easy.
Yeah.